Hello, welcome to the House of Comments podcast. This is a regular podcast featuring myself, Mark Thompson, Lib Dem blogger, and usually featuring my co-host Emma Burnell, Labour blogger. But unfortunately, Emma isn't well at the moment, so she isn't going to be with us today, but we hope that she gets well soon. And joining me today is Mark Wallace, who blogs at Crash Bang Wallace and is a libertarian blogger. Good evening, Mark.
Good evening.
Now, it's the 15th of April. And a week ago today, the news was announced Margaret Thatcher had passed away. And that has dominated the news coverage in the last 7 days. Now, we actually recorded our previous episode on the Sunday, the day before, and I didn't actually release it until after the news about Thatcher had broken. So I tacked on a little thing at the start just to explain that's why we hadn't mentioned it. But today we're going to devote the entire podcast to discussing Margaret Thatcher, her time in office, her legacy, and everything that's happened since. So, Mark, just to start off with, what are your thoughts about Margaret Thatcher? I mean, do you actually remember when she was in office?
I do, yes, vaguely, particularly pointed towards the end of when she was in office. I was born in 1984 to parents who were avowed Thatcherites, and I think probably have identified themselves as Thatcherites before Thatcher realised she was, to be honest with you. They followed the kind of traditional model of meeting at the Young Conservatives, more a dating club than a political organisation as it was at the time. And so she did play a large role in my childhood, and also, of course, I was born and grew up in the northeast of England, so at that time she was a controversial figure, even then, in and around my childhood. I mean, even over and above her political impact, it felt like the end of an era last week to hear the news that really, having grown up with her as Prime Minister, in the unusual situation of it almost feeling during our childhood like it was obvious that a woman would be Prime Minister, whereas in fact now, obviously looking back on history, you realise that it's such a rarity that she's been the only one. It was a remarkable bit of news that I think made a lot of people stop and think very deeply about our recent history.
Yeah, oh, quite fascinating. You say you grew up in the northeast. Did you live near any mining communities?
Pretty close. So I grew up in North Tyneside, a place called Whitley Bay. I was born in North Shields, which was the right next door to the home of Swan Hunters, the shipyards just south of Ashington, the large mining community. My grandfather worked in the shipyards, and on the other side of the family had worked in the mines. So it was an inalienable bit of the landscape of every single part of the northeast, really. So it is something that, you know, even back home to this day, is extremely controversial, as we've seen over the last week, and it's something that almost inevitably was going to continue to draw comment and debate, you know, long after she ceased being Prime Minister.
Yeah, did you find that the views of your parents were kind of in the minority, in a small minority, in living near communities like that, or were they more widespread? Because I think there's this idea that in the south she was revered, but in the north most people, you know, didn't like her.
Yeah, I think it's really not controversial to say the northeast of England is not the home of Margaret Thatcher's biggest fan base. but it was a lot more mixed even at the time, I think, than the modern view of that time and the region is. I mean, I think a lot of the time people look at our friends in the north and think everything was exactly like that. At the time, we were living in Tynemouth, which was a Tory constituency throughout the Thatcher years, and my parents were, you know, when they were going out leafleting for the Tory party, they were leafleting for a sitting MP in the northeast, and indeed, to this day, you know, right now, North Tyneside is a Conservative control council. It's the only metropolitan Conservative control council in the northeast of England. And so I do think it's more mixed picture. It's certainly the case there's a lot of anger about it. I still remember quite vividly as a child, even in 1992 with the general election, there being protests in the centre of Newcastle about the fact that Conservatives had won another election. So it continued to be controversial, but it was definitely a much more mixed picture than has since been portrayed. You know, people forget, for example, an awful lot of people who chose to go to work in the mines, despite what Arthur Scargill was arguing in terms of calling everyone out on strike without a ballot, were driven out of their homes. And you know, those were people who lived near us, who were having their kids threatened, who were having their windows smashed in, and eventually a lot of them had to leave the communities where they'd grown up.
Yeah. I mean, my upbringing was pretty much the polar opposite of what you've just described. My parents were staunch socialists. They didn't actually meet at a kind of, you know, Labour Party or Socialist Worker Party ball or anything. They probably didn't have balls like that in the area where my parents grew up, to be honest. But they were card-carrying members of the Labour Party. They both really intensely disliked Margaret Thatcher and what she stood for. And I was left under no illusion when I was growing up as a child. I mean, I was born a bit earlier than you. I was born in 74. So I don't remember Margaret Thatcher being elected as Prime Minister, but I do remember the Falklands War. And a bit like yourself, for me, a woman Prime Minister was just normal for, you know, until I was 16 years old when she was finally removed from office by her own party. And it wasn't just my parents, actually, my grandparents and most people that I spoke to about politics when I was a youngster, I guess, because they were either family members or extended family members or friends of the family, all didn't like Margaret Thatcher at all. And so that was how I was brought up. And I think what I've found over the years is that certainly when I was kind of a teenager, I would say my political views were understandably very similar to my parents. But what's happened over the years is that as I've learned more, as I've read more, and I've read lots of biographies and studied the period, I've read Margaret Thatcher's the Downing Street years, her biography of her time in office. And I think I've come to, even before she died, I'd already come to a more nuanced view about her time in office. I mean, I did a blog post just after she died where I didn't feel like it was right for me to start slagging her off, basically. You know, mm-hmm. She just died. And there will be plenty of time, as far as I'm concerned, for a proper appraisal of her time in office and her legacy. But I didn't feel like the day after she died, when I was writing a blog post, it was right for me to do that. And instead, what I did was I actually wrote a blog post entitled Three Good Things That Margaret Thatcher Did. And I picked out telecoms privatisation. I picked out some of the trade union reforms. And I picked out the fact that she was the first female prime minister, and therefore she actually smashed the glass ceiling that I think a lot of people thought maybe never would be smashed, or at least not in their lifetimes. I could also have picked the Falklands War, although that was maybe a little bit more down to luck than judgment in the way that played out, but it was certainly a good thing, and it certainly seemed to unite the country. I mean, what are your thoughts about, you know, specific policy? I mean, I guess you must think quite a lot of what she did was good. Would you pick anything out in particular?
Well, I think, as you say, you do go through this process as you grow up and as you grow out of the kind of influence of your parents, almost, of kind of reevaluating things. And I remember quite vividly, and this is a hugely, hugely geeky thing to confess to, the moment when I kind of started to realise, although I wouldn't have known the word at that time, that I was maybe a libertarian rather than just a through and through Thatcherite Tory, which is actually when in 1994, I believe, when they started introducing under John Major Sunday trading. My mum was running some small shops, three or four small shops that she inherited from my granddad that he'd set up in the 50s, and my parents were bitterly opposed. And I remember kind of thinking, I was told about, you know, free competition, the opportunity for businesses to grow and people to work hard and all the rest of it. And actually, I was surprised to learn recently, although I didn't know at the time, that actually Margaret Thatcher's only parliamentary defeat came when she originally proposed Sunday trading being allowed, I think, in 1986, and she was defeated by a rebellion of her own MPs. I think there are, you know, as you say, quite a few things I would point to that she did right. I think while the word's been much maligned, you know, the broad privatisation of huge monolithic industries that the state owned and ran extremely badly was a good thing. It was a necessary thing. To be honest, it was an inevitable thing. And whilst I think particularly the absolute cock-up of the railways in the 1990s has given the word a bad name, actually, if you look at the real facts of influence on things like our energy sector, water, and particularly the success of the privatisation of BT, for example, I think those were a success, and not only privatising them, but actually privatising them in a drive to encourage ordinary people, you know, individual people who would not otherwise become stock market traders or billionaires, to buy the shares in them, to take the opportunity to take up ownership. I think that was a positive thing, although I'd argue it wasn't really driven through to the point where it would be fully cemented in our society. And I think we've seen a lot of that fall back in recent years with negative effects. I actually think the attitude that she took towards politics in general has had a huge impact, and that impact is still playing out in Parliament now. this is exactly what I wrote about, like you, after Margaret Thatcher died, after the news broke last week. I kind of felt thousands and thousands of words were being written by a huge number of different people, many of whom had known her, many of whom were there at the time, as parliamentarians and so on. And I kind of thought, well, I'm not just going to jump in on, you know, and just try and list off different decisions or different historical events, but instead to look at what her kind of ideological impact was, what her ideas and what her general approach was. And actually, for me, it was her changing of the centre-right into something that was broadly a revolutionary movement rather than a purely reactionary, old-school conservative movement. You know, if you look at the way a lot of the old conservative establishment, particularly the aristocratic conservative establishment, hated Margaret Thatcher, the way they tried to stop her being selected as an MP in the first place, the way they mocked her when she became a minister, the way they really disliked the idea that she might become leader instead of someone instead of some of her predecessors. She took an attitude that actually said that simple institutions, which had previously been absolutely revered without question in conservatism, were not inherently good. Embedded elites were not inherently a beneficial thing, and actually they should be challenged in the interests of the wider population. And that, I think, is something which is going to have a huge impact in the coming decades as well. It has a huge impact on the view of the conservative backbenchers now. As you say, the Falklands War is another thing I'd point to, but as part of a broader sweep in terms of her willingness to actually stand up against, you know, tin pot dictatorships like that in Argentina, but also against the Soviet Union, more broadly, Ronald Reagan's evil empire, has had a huge effect. I thought it was remarkable last week that when in the UK we were having this kind of quite controversial debate, it was leadership figures in the Polish government who were coming out and proposing a statue of Margaret Thatcher in Warsaw. Because if you go to meet political people, actually of all different sides of the political divide in the former Soviet Union, in the former Warsaw Pact countries, those people will tell you exactly what a big change Margaret Thatcher helped to make. And, you know, didn't make alone, but helped to make in their lives. And I think that is a huge contribution, not just to not just economically and politically, but fundamentally to humanity. That was a humanistic benefit that she made. And actually, she reversed an attitude that had been embedded beforehand, which was if we dared to try and stand up to the Soviet Union, we would bring on a war. In 1979, she was being criticised for language criticising the Soviet Union too strongly, that it might bring on a nuclear war and destroy us all. And instead, she stood up for what she thought was right, and the right of the people who, you know, we were in a land far away of whom we know nothing, you could say, and it turned out to be correct.
Yeah. I had a rather interesting reaction a few months ago when the Argentinians were saber-rattling about the Falklands, and there was, you know, discussion about potentially some kind of negotiated settlement and all of that stuff. And I was listening to something on the radio where they were talking about this, and I think they had a clip of an Argentinian politician or someone, or an ambassador or something, making some statement about this. I actually found a kind of visceral, atavistic almost reaction against what he was saying. That isn't like me at all, but I think the fact that the Falklands War was one of my earliest memories, my earliest political memories, and, you know, so many of our soldiers died to protect that, you know, small island that is thousands of miles away. And I found myself shouting at the radio, which, like I say, that's not something I would normally do over a subject like that anyway. And I think that kind of demonstrates just how seared in the collective consciousness what Margaret Thatcher actually did for the country. Because, like I say, I was not brought up in an environment where she was in favour at all. And yet I still found myself on some level being very grateful for the fact that, you know, that happened in the way that it did, and, you know, that we stood up for it. And I would like to think that if another party had been in power, or even if there'd been a different prime minister, a different conservative prime minister, that it would have happened in the same way. But we can't be sure about that. Like you say, it's easy to look at history and think that was always the way it was going to play out. And actually, in reality, that's not necessarily the case at all. I wanted to just unpack a couple of the other things that you said, though, because you were talking about the way that she approached politics and the kind of legacy of that. And there's a flip side to that, though, isn't there? Because she did want our nation to become a nation of shareholders. That was her aim with those privatizations. And although lots of people did buy the shares, and I remember the advertising campaigns for British Gas shares and for British Telecom shares, you know, and I think members of my own family had bought shares in them. But what seemed to happen quite quickly was that the shares were bought, quick profits were turned, then the shares were sold off, and quite quickly those shares ended up being owned by banking organisations that actually hold the funds. And so the idea that you had millions and millions of people who were going to be substantial shareholders in aggregate of these companies in the end didn't really play out. And instead, what that sort of thing fostered was what some people would refer to as like a culture of greed. You know, the fact that there was the Big Bang in 1986, and whenever you see a montage of the mid to late 80s, you always get these pictures of the traders with the braces and the shouting across the trading floors and all of that stuff. It did seem to usher in an age of selfishness in a way. And it wasn't that everyone was in this. It was a select group of people who did very, very well. And great swathes of the country didn't do very well at all. In fact, areas like former mining communities, like we were just talking about, actually suffered terribly badly under her.
Absolutely. And I think you can point to two broad themes in terms of the flaws of Margaret Thatcher's premiership, where you can look at the things which she left either undone or uncompleted. I think one of those would be, for example, the attitude towards the way in which her, if you look at a lot of what she said and wrote, her attitude towards large mega multinational companies was not, as is often portrayed, one of she absolutely loved them. It was one where actually institutions of the kind of corporatist institutions, as it were almost as bad as state sector massive institutions. But that was something that was left undone. For example, I think if you look at what is currently being done by the government in terms of increasing shareholder rights to actually for ordinary shareholders to be able to vote down in some circumstances the pay packets of people sitting at the top of companies, that was something that arguably should have been done a very long time ago and should have been done an awful lot further. I find it hard to criticise her too much for not getting through everything that she could have sold. Partially because if you think back to 1979, there were so many things wrong when her government took over that it's undeniable that it was a revolution that remained unfinished. I think the second thing you can look at is things where she was just plain wrong, and actually the way in which the transition of former mining communities, for example, was it wasn't even mismanaged. There just wasn't a plan for a transition. That was something that was clearly absolutely wrong. And speaking as somebody who absolutely supports her decision when it came to the public funding of the mines, the subsidies and the protectionism for the mining industry, it was a really serious mistake and had a huge negative impact on an awful lot of people to not have a plan to properly transfer those communities and equip them to actually different parts of the economy. You know, where you have patches of success, if you look at, say, the Nissan factory in Sunderland that helps drive the northeast of England now to become somewhere that manufactures more cars than the whole of Italy every year, which is a remarkable success, that shouldn't have been the one-off. Things like that should have been the norm. And I think there were some pretty unattractive political reasons why those things didn't happen. You know, they started off thinking that closing the remaining mines was going to be necessary. And I think the process of going through the miners' strike, I think the rhetoric of openly revolutionary socialists like Arthur Scargill and various others, helped to turn this purely into, by the end of the 1980s in particular, into an us and them argument. And what they should have done was to rise above that, to stay true to some of the things of St. Francis of Assisi that she quoted on her first arrival at Downing Street in 1979, and to actually bring harmony, even if it was against the government's better instincts, and they felt they were helping people who were absolutely dedicated to their downfall.
I think that
wasn't done.
Yeah, and I think you've raised an important point there, because I think some of the coverage that we've seen in the last week has rather glossed over some of the deeper-seated reasons for why things like the mining communities weren't looked after properly after the mines were closed. And I think you've touched upon it there, but I just wanted to go a bit more deeply into it, because having read her autobiography and read around that subject a fair bit. She really did see her struggle against the NUM and Arthur Scargill in particular as a fight against people who basically wanted to subvert the democracy of the country and take over the country, socialism by the back door, basically. She really did see it in those stark terms. And so I think that in the end, when she finally won that battle, for want of a better word, that as far as she was concerned, that was it, and it was time to move on from that. And she didn't do what she should have done, which is recognise that there were hundreds of thousands of people, you know, maybe millions when you consider the wider effects, affected by what had happened, and that they were citizens of her country and that she should have looked after them. And I feel like she was blinded by, like, the phrase that you used and that she used to use as well, the them and us mentality. Well, actually, she probably never used them and us, but she always used to say, you know, is he one of us? Is she one of us? She was, in that respect, she was, I think she did the people a disservice. So it's easy to gloss over that and to think, well, more should have been done. You know, it was an accident. I don't really feel like it was an accident. I also don't necessarily think it was deliberate. I don't think she callously decided to punish the communities. Mm. I just think she was so focused on the battle. And after the battle was won, she just moved on to the next battle. And she didn't really think about what was left behind until it was far too late.
Yeah, I think it's important also to look at the way that actually that was something that was in many ways was forged during the Battle of the Miners' Strike. It's certainly not something that, you know, I think a lot of people would like to think this is something that Mrs. Thatcher entered government intending to be doing in 10 years' time. And I think it's actually something that was very much forged in that kind of crucible of the miners' strike in places like Orgreave, famously. And if you look at the things that she was doing early in her premiership, particularly in the first few years, she was talking about our people. She was talking about people who had those values of aspiration, who had those that hard work ethic and get ahead through the sweat of your brow approach to life. But she was also looking at ways to actually help to encourage people to take up those values and to adopt them. I think if you look at things like council house sales, that wasn't simply saying we're out for people who've got small businesses and we want to help them, or we're out for people who've got this work ethic. That was actually saying, let's look at ways to introduce people to these kind of opportunities. Let's look at government policies that can show people the benefits of, for example, home ownership in that particular case, and adopt it. And actually, if those people disagree with us to start off with, then hopefully when they try the policies out and they see that they work, they will actually look again at the wider worldview. That was actually a remarkably open-minded thing to do, and I think it's something which politicians today could probably learn a lot from on all sides. But that was not something that was present in the later years. It was not something that happened when it came to those mining communities. And you know, the uncomfortable fact is that when Margaret Thatcher took the view that Arthur Scargill was somebody who wanted to subvert democracy in this country, who wanted to overthrow the democratically elected government and so on, actually she was right. He was pretty open about that, and he's been pretty open about it to this day. Does that mean that the individual people who were led to such disaster by him, their families and their communities, should have been simply left hanging at the end of the miners' strike after the mines had gone? Of course it doesn't. And that was a failing where actually emotion and the way, you know, for somebody who supposedly was quite an emotionless prime minister, if you listen to a lot of her critics, emotion did get the better on that, and it was a mistake. But it's a mistake that's really important that we study why it happened and how it could have been averted.
Mm. So if we could maybe just move on to talk a bit more about what happened towards the end of her premiership, because that's a period of time that I can remember more vividly, because I was starting to become politically aware. I remember the Westland affair. I remember John Cole being a BBC political reporter. He might have been the editor at the time, always going on. I'll try and do the accent about the Westland affair. I just remember that. I remember that phrase over and over again. And I know Michael Heseltine resigned over that. And then she won the 1987 election. But as we started to move towards the late 90s, the feeling that I get is that she started to get more and more out of touch with the members of her own party, but perhaps more importantly with the public. I think this inevitably happens to political leaders that are in office for a long time, that I think she had a very acute political antennae in her early years, but it really started to fail her as we got towards the late 80s. I mean, the example of this would be the poll tax, which was bubbling under for quite a long time. And now you get former minister after former minister coming forward saying, I warned Margaret Thatcher that the poll tax would be dreadful. I heard David Mellor on LBC saying this the other day. And apparently, by all accounts, she just wouldn't listen. She just didn't want to listen and ended up with riots in the streets. I think there was that. And then there was also the things that were happening with Europe that were causing problems as well. And it probably sounds a bit strange to say it now, but there were senior members of the Tory party and cabinet ministers, Tory cabinet ministers, who were very pro-European and who didn't like the direction that things were moving in and the way that Margaret Thatcher was talking about Europe. And I don't know whether that was ultimately the trigger that led to Geoffrey Howe resigning and making the speech that he did that essentially brought her down. I mean, what are your thoughts about that period of office? Do you think it was inevitable that the members of her own party were going to remove her from office? Or do you think things could have played out differently if maybe she'd done the odd thing differently, or maybe cabinet ministers had taken a different decision and not all trooped in one after another to tell her her time was up? Do you think she could have carried on? Do you think she could have conceivably won another election?
Well, I think if you look back, firstly, I think you're absolutely right. You can see the onset of the disease of successful governments. If you look back at the footage, if you look back at the policies, if you look back at the speeches, the photographs, the outfits, the whole culture and feel of that era, particularly in the last couple of years of the 80s, smacks of a government which has started to become out of touch with the people in particular. I would draw this down to a couple of different things. Firstly, of course, an awful lot of ministers pop up now and explain how right they were, and if only they'd been listened to, they'd be absolutely right. I think we're in a slightly troubling situation when David Miller's anything other than a warning from history, to be honest with you. But to a certain extent, I think this is actually one of the greater successes of the IRA. If Norman Tebbit had not been obviously injured himself, but also drawn out of frontline politics through his absolutely honourable commitment to care for his wife, who was severely injured in the Brighton bombing, I suspect actually there would have been a voice there that she respected enough, that was willing to say, no, what are you doing? Can you not see the signs? And actually, it was a great success of the IRA that he wasn't there. I thought it was really remarkable and one of the most, what sounds like one of those truthful speeches and honest speeches of the tributes to her in Parliament last week, when we heard Lord Tebbit stand up and actually talk about that time, that when he'd had to step back from being by her side, and actually when she asked him to come back in the late 80s, he had to say, he felt obligated to say no, that his first commitment had to be with his wife. I suspect had the Brighton bomb not had that effect, then maybe there would have been a chance that actually there was somebody there who was bloody minded enough to dig his heels in and to explain to her the problems, and also somebody that actually she respected and trusted enough to listen to on topics, perhaps topics like the poll tax, not necessarily initially, but certainly once it started to show its very early signs of going severely wrong. That said, we can't be in this kind of fantasy world of any prime minister being able to go on forever. It's not something that's practical or politically practical or humanly, physically possible. It's not even something that I think is democratically desirable. I know Nigel Farage has kind of said if Margaret Thatcher was there in 1992, UKIP would never have become necessary, would never have started. Well, that may or may not be the case. But the simple fact is it could not have gone on forever. I also find it hard to imagine that even though it's arguable that she'd started to believe some of the rhetoric that was being broadcast about her government, that she would have been there certainly any longer than running up to a 1992 election. I find it very hard to imagine. And of course, the fact is that had she gone on and on, then times would have changed around her anyway. She was very much a politician of her time, and she came forward to deal with a particular set of challenges that faced the nation, and particularly the malaise that beset the nation. That was her appeal. That's what she got so acutely in the 1970s in particular and the early 1980s. That's where you can, if you look at the remarkable change between the broadcasts and appearances she was doing as leader of the opposition or as a relatively new prime minister, famously framed around her being a housewife, looking at household budgets and so on, explaining how they apply to the nation. If you compare that to some of the more regal appearances in the late 1980s, the difference is remarkable. And then, you know, the world was going to carry on turning and changing, whether she was prime minister or not. I think eventually it would have overtaken her. It's in the, as I think Enoch Powell said, all political careers end in failure. So it was inevitable to a certain extent.
Yeah, I think you're right. And interesting point you made about Norman Tebbit there, and I'm sure that's right. I'm sure if Tebbit had been around in the mid to late 80s, things would likely have played out quite differently, because he was a very close lieutenant. He was one of the people who was willing to speak truth to power in that respect. And actually, I also wonder if Airey Neave hadn't also have been killed by the, Norman Tebbit was killed, but, you know, he, like you say, their actions took him out of frontline politics. But Airey Neave, who was one of her closest lieutenants when she was in opposition, was killed by the IRA in 1979. And again, I think she felt that loss very, very deeply. He was very, very close to her and would have been another one of these people, had he still been alive, who would have maybe been able to steer in different directions. But I totally take your point that, you know, you can sit here and play the counterfactual game as much as you like. You know, it played out the way it played out. I think your reference to Nigel Farage's comments about 1992 and whether UKIP would have been necessary, I think play into a slightly broader point, which I wanted to discuss, which is the mythology that's grown up around Margaret Thatcher since she left office. So obviously it's been highly intense focus on that period in the last week since she's died. But it's been happening for the last couple of decades that her time in office has been, well, for people on the right and people who liked her, there's almost like a hagiographic veneration that goes on now. That she, you know, unlike this discussion we've had, which I think has been reasonably balanced, you know, to some people on the right, she basically could do no wrong, and she was, you know, she was absolutely fantastic, and, you know, she should have gone on and on and on and on. And to people on the left, she was the most evil prime minister we've ever had, and, you know, she was deliberately callous and all the rest of it. Obviously, it's a cliche that we've heard many, many times now, but she was a polarizing figure. But I fear that the Tory party today is at risk of mythologizing her to such an extent that no politician, no contemporary politician or future politician is ever going to be able to live up to this idea that they now have, the collective Tory party idea of what Margaret Thatcher was, what she stood for and what she did. I don't think it has a passing resemblance to the truth in some ways, but it's massively exaggerated. And I think there was an interesting piece by Peter Kellner in The Guardian today, where he actually suggests that what the Conservative Party need is some kind of movement to move on from Margaret Thatcher. He says that the Democrats in the US had a similar movement in 1998 after the Lewinsky scandal with Bill Clinton happened. So they wanted to move on from Clinton and started to put processes in place to find suitable candidates. Apparently that process helped to find Obama, for example. I mean, what are your thoughts about this? I don't know how close you are to people within the Conservative Party, but do you think there is truth in this idea that there are some in the Tory party, perhaps quite a lot, who venerate Margaret Thatcher to an extent that just actually doesn't bear historical analysis?
I think she was a huge figure. She was an absolute giant. So she does cast an extremely long shadow, particularly over the Conservative Party. And it's certainly true to say that every single Conservative leader since has been judged against her successes, against her stature, and to a certain extent against her attitudes and policies. I mean, let's not forget that William Hague, one of the reasons William Hague was successful in 1997 to become Conservative Party leader was because he had her endorsement. So that arguably the individual even the individual actions of her after becoming Prime Minister still have their impact on who is a big beast in the Conservative Party now and who isn't.
But it's also quite interesting though with Hague, as soon as you mentioned him, that that, I mean, I don't think Haig was going to win in 2001. I think history was just against him, given the massive landslide that Labour had in 97 and how long the Tories had been in power beforehand. But it was very notable that one of the main campaign posters of the 2001 general election was a picture of William Haig with Margaret Thatcher's hairstyle imposed upon him, superimposed, with a slogan that said, "Don't let them get back in again." You know, that's how polarising a figure she was, that whilst she was instrumental in getting him elected in the first place as leader, and that clearly appealed to a lot of Conservative members and Conservative voters, when it actually came to the election, Margaret Thatcher was used against him as effectively by the other side.
Absolutely. It was Labour's equivalent to the Demon Eyes poster to a certain extent, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I think there... It's absolutely necessary, and I think you mean very few Conservatives who certainly privately would disagree with the idea that it is important for us to move on. I speak as somebody who's a big fan of the attitude and many of the policies that she implemented, and certainly like many Conservative Party members, I'm a big fan of the idea of winning elections again, which has been an extremely long time. The difficulty is, how do you deal with the idea that you can move on, you can address the 21st century challenges? I mean, it seems crazy that we're talking about the idea of maybe addressing 21st century challenges only 13 years into the century. But nonetheless, that does need to happen. I suspect that now that Margaret Thatcher has died, and that actually we've gone through this process of remembering and analysing and debating and so on, that actually, to a certain extent, this will be a watershed in that process. The interesting question is exactly what elements of Margaret Thatcher as a politician, as a prime minister, as a campaigner, and of course Thatcherism and the Thatcherites, who still soldier on. Which elements do you pick up? Which elements do you adapt? And which elements do you learn from? And which elements do you drop? Or, you know, for example, to take the David Cameron quote, there is such a thing as society. Which elements do you go out of your way to kind of decry and disown? But I think that process is starting. I think it is becoming easier to actually say Margaret Thatcher was a good, I believe as a Conservative, Margaret Thatcher was a good Prime Minister. She was a success. She was certainly one of the very greatest peacetime Prime Ministers of the 20th century. But that, you know, for example, that she got things wrong. A few years ago, I wrote an article on Conservative Home about local government, where I said that actually Margaret Thatcher got local government really severely wrong. You know, the idea of centralising control over local government to try and remove the authority and the powers of, say, loony lefty authorities like that in Liverpool, which was deeply infiltrated by militant tendency and so on. I understand why she did it, but it was based on the flawed assumption that either her or people like her would be in charge forever. You know, instead, once you'd centralised those powers and allowed New Labour to misuse them and to force an awful lot of things, an awful lot of bad ideas on good local councils as well, once they're in power. I wrote that, you know, I guess it was probably 5 years ago or so, with a thought in the back of my mind that actually I might get completely savaged for it, but actually people, even people who were avowed Thatcher enthusiasts, still, dealt with it pretty well. And it is kind of silly, and it probably undoubtedly seems silly to outsiders, that those outside the Conservative Party, that is a, you know, something which is a sign of progress and has changed. But it has changed, and I think we are able increasingly to be able to assess what was good, what was bad, and to move on from that.
I just want to stick with this for a minute, though, because there's another kind of angle to this that I want to explore. Margaret Thatcher, this kind of mythology that's grown up around her, that she was, you know, a very, very ideological politician, that she was, you know, she knew exactly what she wanted and she was going to get it. I mean, again, some of that is true. But if you'd have sat down in 1977 or 1978 and tried to work out what she was going to do if she became Prime Minister, I don't think you'd have had anything. You certainly wouldn't have had a clear idea of what she was going to do, because like any politician in opposition, she was careful. You know, this phrase, the Overton window, the ground, the narrow window in which politics can be debated. And, you know, what you do is in opposition, you try and tack to the centre. And then once you're in power, you try and move where the centre is. I mean, she was good at that, but she was actually quite a pragmatic politician. And if you read some of the the papers and the memoirs of people around her, and you know, some of these papers that get released under the 20-year rule. You find that, or is it, sorry, 30-year rule? You find that she was actually very nervous. She didn't think that she was this kind of invincible, massively powerful leader. She was careful, certainly in her early years, to keep the Tory wets on board. She didn't just come in and just get rid of all the wets and get all her own people in. It wasn't until the last few years of her time in office that she, you know, when she was so powerful because she'd been in for so long, that she really did force her way through on a lot of issues, like we've already talked about, the poll tax. And therefore, I think that the contemporary Conservative Party is at risk of learning the wrong lessons, because I think there are people, certainly on the right of the Conservative Party, who think that if they were just a bit more like, if the party was just a bit more like Thatcher, the party was just a bit more right-wing, a bit more Thatcherite, then the Conservative Party would be winning elections and they'd be winning majorities like Margaret Thatcher had in the 80s. And I think that's learning the wrong lesson from history. She was actually a very astute, canny politician. It was when she really became that ideological figure that wouldn't listen to other people and just pushed ahead with what she wanted in the last 2 or 3 years, that was her downfall.
I think you're right in some ways. A lot of history is always kind of coloured by things that have happened since. And we've gone through a period in which the word ideology is inherently a dirty word. You can actually see this in the things that the shadow cabinet say at the moment. So something is an ideological policy, which kind of plays up to the idea that not having an ideology is somehow means that you listen to evidence, and having an ideology means you ignore evidence, which is quite a bizarre, or would seem to a lot of people from past decades to be quite a bizarre worldview. But we can't deny that's something that's come about as a perception which is quite widespread, even among very experienced, intelligent politicians and commentators and so on. I think what's important to realise is that, yes, Margaret Thatcher was extremely pragmatic. Yes, she, particularly, you know, before things, for example, the poll tax, she knew when she was on to a loser, and was willing to backtrack, to compromise, and to ditch ideas or issues that weren't going anywhere. The distinction is that doing that does not mean that you're not an ideological person. Margaret Thatcher knew in her gut what she believed, what she liked and what she didn't like. It doesn't mean that actually she always dug her heels in on every single topic and was totally unwilling to compromise, as you say. You know, otherwise she would not have been as successful a campaigner, or certainly as successful a prime minister as she turned out to be. But the fact is that some of this is pure mythology. You know, it's absolutely true that she didn't arrive in government in 1979 on a manifesto that laid out everything that happened in that parliament, never mind in the next decade. But it is also true that, you know, in 1945, we're having just read F.A. Hayek's newly published The Road to Serfdom, that she was touting it around fellow Conservatives. It is true that she apparently chucked it on the cabinet table and said, this is what we believe. And I think there's a distinction there. The idea that, yes, you need to be pragmatic and effective campaigner, talk to people and adapt to circumstances. I don't think many people would argue with that. The distinction, I think the unsettling thing, is the feeling that not just in the Conservative Party, but actually in all three parties to a greater or lesser degree, or three main parties, that actually maybe there is no decision which would make you feel uncomfortable. Maybe there is no topic that actually you wouldn't mind considering. Maybe there isn't a gut instinct, that kind of ideological underpinning in quite a lot of our leading politicians. I think that is something which is more troubling to a wider group of people than just those who call themselves Thatcherites.
Yeah.
But I do agree that if you were to take the view that Margaret Thatcher was right on everything, you quickly end up in a bit of a mess. You know, was Margaret Thatcher right to say no to Brussels and right to get the rebate, or was she right to pass the Single European Act? Or was she right to campaign in favour of a yes vote in the 1935 referendum? You know, the fact is, on Europe, for example, which was part of her downfall in the end, although she was right on it in my view, she changed her mind. She realised that actually she'd made some mistakes or failed to be far-sighted enough as to what kind of project it was that she was supporting. So, you know, it's very, very interesting. If you ask people for to try and be consistent on some of their assumptions here, they quickly end up in a mess if they're being too rigid. The same goes for a lot of Thatcher's critics. You know, an awful lot of people who will tell you that she was completely evil will refuse to give an answer to, would you prefer we had Britain, would you prefer Britain of 1979 or 1990?
Yeah.
And you know, it's always the way that if people try and fit some kind of perfect rule to the world, unless they're a very, very clever physicist, they quickly end up in trouble.
Yeah, I a couple of things on that. I thought that it was very generous and honest, actually, of David Cameron when he became Prime Minister in that speech he made on Downing Street steps before he walked through the door. He actually paid tribute to the Labour government of the previous 13 years and said that the country is better now than it was in 1997. And I thought that was a very generous thing to say. But like I say, it was actually true, because I think the country was better after, you know, I think the Labour government did some good things and he was basically acknowledging that. Just to come back to the other point as well, I think it's worth noting that, for example, I mean, the trade union reforms that Thatcher brought in didn't happen until her second term. She had a chance to face down the miners in 1981 and she backed off because she wasn't ready. She couldn't have known that she was going to win a second term. So it was possible that Margaret Thatcher could have been a prime minister that actually didn't do the trade union reform. She didn't come in and do them straight away. She waited. She was careful. She was cautious. And I think it's things like that, when you look at the history, you look at what actually happened, that it's easy to see it misrepresented and to assume that it was always going to happen. You know, it wouldn't necessarily have played out like that. But I think you are right that, you know, any successful politician has to have a blend of the pragmatic and the ideological. And I guess it's a case of, you know, what kind of mix do you have of those things? I don't necessarily think ideology is a dirty word, but I do think that when ideology is raised above all else, and, you know, you get these politicians who are very, very ideological, then I think it can be damaging, because I think there is a real risk that you do ignore the evidence and that you just carry on with policies that are failing because, you know, they were the policies that you wanted, and you almost end up with the evidence to fit the policies rather than the other way around. I just wanted to, just before we finish, just to come on to what's happened in the last week. What are your thoughts, Mark, about how the coverage has played out and about the various campaigns and protests? I don't want to really dwell too much on, you know, stuff like the Ding Dong song, and, you know, I heard today that they're going to stop Big Ben during the funeral. I'm not really that interested in that stuff, but more the kind of the general tenor of the coverage. And, you know, do you think that it's been fair and balanced, the coverage that's been in the media?
Overall, I've been pleasantly surprised, actually, by the coverage of the media and the reaction from prominent figures, including Ed Miliband. You know, I think Ed Miliband deserves a lot of credit, not just for the tribute he paid to Margaret Thatcher in the House of Commons, but actually for the discipline and the decency which he's managed to instill within an awful lot in the vast, vast majority of his colleagues, many of whom were, you know, almost certainly champing at the bit to behave in a way which would have done themselves and their party and their wider views no credit whatsoever. So overall, I have been impressed. I think there were I always tend towards the view that sometimes the BBC will overreach itself in exactly what it thinks is balanced. But actually, I think, you know, if you look at some of the public service broadcasting in the last few days, particularly, say, Martin Durkin's documentary about Thatcher the Revolutionary, which aired on Saturday night, you know, I actually think there's been an opportunity to explore the light and the dark, but also some of the grey in between of Margaret Thatcher's premiership and her legacy. It spoke an awful lot for me that whilst obviously I, you know, as you can imagine, I very strongly dislike the idea of going to a Trafalgar Square party at someone's death, it spoke very strongly to me two things. Firstly, that that party was allowed to go on. I think absolutely rightly, Margaret Thatcher did speak fundamentally for individual freedom, particularly politically, and I think it was right that was allowed to happen. But also, what greater statement can there be than the fact that actually the, you know, those big revolutionary movements that were arranged against her that could bring the government to its knees, you know, 29 million strike days in 1979, were reduced to having a party of a few thousand people in Trafalgar Square all organised through iPhones. You know, I think that shows the really fundamental scale of the revolution she brought to this country. So overall, I think it's been quite a positive few days. Obviously, we're speaking before the funeral is actually going to take place, so you know, maybe things haven't fully played themselves out yet, but overall I've been pleasantly surprised.
Mm. And do you think that the funeral, the way it's been arranged, do you think it's appropriate, and do you think it's right that £10 million of taxpayers' money should be spent on it?
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is that obviously press and media estimates are always slightly uncertain until after someone's actually gone and totted up the numbers afterwards. You know, I'm a low-tax, small-state, low-spending hawk when it comes to fiscal issues. You know, I do think Margaret Thatcher, from what I've read, was very keen that a huge amount of money should not be squandered, as she seems to have viewed it, on going over the top on her funeral. But I think it's right that someone who, you know, ideology and politics and party aside, someone who was Britain's first and so far only female prime minister is commemorated at the proper level. And you know, I know if people want to get down to bean counting, you could say the EU budget rebate has more than paid for a little bit of money in those terms to be spent on this. But I do think it's right, actually, that her individual achievements, overcoming the bigotry, frankly, against her on the grounds of her gender and on the grounds of her class, from within her party, from her opponents, and all sorts of different people in her career, I do think it's right that that's honoured, and I do think it's right that there's a proper opportunity for a commemoration. Obviously, as I said, being happily a free country, there'll be protesters there as well, but frankly, I don't think she would want any other way.
Yeah, I mean, I personally think, from what I've heard, it is a bit lavish, and I'm not convinced that it's the amount of money that's going to be spent on it and how lavish it is what she'd have wanted, but it's not really my place to second guess that. I don't know for definite. But in terms of the fact that we have a commoner who is having what is, to all intents and purposes, a state funeral, I mean, it's slightly mischievous of me to say this, but as a confirmed Republican, I'm quite happy if commoners can have state funerals like this, because, you know, just slowly, slowly, it starts to chip away at the edifice of the, you know, the fact that it's only the, you know, the royal family that have occasions like this. I think, you know, personally, I would prefer it if we had an elected head of state, and, you know, and then we'd be having state funerals for commoners all the time. So I don't necessarily have a problem with it. I do wonder if we're starting to set a precedent, though. I wonder what's going to happen when Blair dies, when John Major dies. You know, a little bit like we've seen with, you know, some other precedents that have been set over the years, that I just wonder if there will be a clamour for more, you know, even if they're not exactly state funerals, this is described as a ceremonial funeral, you know, whether we are finding that a precedent will have been set here.
Almost certainly, yeah, there's bound to be an argument over it, partially because people want to make party political points, but partially because we've got a kind of modern obsession with having hard and fast rules that apply to everything, that we can explain every single hypothetical circumstance that might come up in the future, how would it fit under this system. To be honest with you, I think there's some things like the question of silencing Big Ben and so on is getting a little bit farcical. But as I say, I do think an important national event to recognise her achievements is an obvious thing to do. Do I think that means that John Major or Gordon Brown deserve exactly the same? Not necessarily. But sad to say, undoubtedly there'll be thousands of column inches written in the future fighting over exactly that, which is going to be an extremely depressing process to go through.
I think there might be quite a lot of people who think that Gordon Brown doesn't deserve something like that, but maybe we'll maybe leave that for another podcast. There's probably a lot we could say about that. But I'd just like to thank you, Mark, for taking the time to come and talk to me today about this. I think it's been a fascinating insight into the history of, as you rightly point out, one of the most significant figures of the 20th century.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
We'd just like also thank Audio Boo, who hosts the podcast. And I'd like to thank Kevin McLeod at incompitech.com for the theme music, and we'll be back soon.